Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for showing up today. Buckle your seatbelts. We're going to go through a lot of time today. Relief pitching is not a heavily covered topic, and so I'll do my best to explain this, but unfortunately, it may be as quickly as possible. For those of us who are fans of relief pitching, the Hall of Fame class of 2019 is going to bring good news. The writers elected Mariano Rivera, and the committees elected Lee Smith, excuse me. That brings to 8 the number of relief pitchers that are enshrined in the Hall of Fame. The less good news is that 7 of them pitched during the designated hitter era. They virtually all pitched after 1973. The exceptions were Goose Gossage had 2 saves before 1973, and Raleigh Fingers a little more. 85% of his saves were after 1973, so 15% were prior to the designated hitter. The only Hall of Fame reliever who comes from before the designated hitter area was Hoyt Wilhelm. Hoyt Wilhelm retired in 1972, and one of the ways we can look at how he fits in, too, with the rest of these guys is to look at his save growth chart. If you look very carefully, our good friends at Baseball Reference give a proportion of saves. It's actually the number, relative number of games saved during a particular year. They take the total number of saves and divide it by the total number of games, and that gives us a nice proportion. Here in 2015, the proportion for the entire major leagues was about 0.27, which is about 1 in 4 games, which is very typical for modern baseball right now. If we look at Baseball Reference's official history of the game, which goes back to 1871, thank you guys, I really appreciate that much hard work, and take it up to 2013, which is the year that Mariano Rivera retires, we form a graph, and I hope I can't see from here, I hope that's fairly visible, but it's a classic growth graph. It starts off very slow, grows very quickly, and then plateaus in the 2000s. To kind of put that in perspective, if you look, you'll see that during the 1800s, the roughly 1 in 33 games ended in a relief pitcher saving the game. When you get into the 2000s, about 1 in 4 games ends with a relief pitcher coming in. And in between, you can see that there's this clear pattern of growth. Now, one of the ways to look at this pattern of growth is to take the Baseball Hall of Fame's timelines. These are based largely on the mortality of their enshrinees, but who am I to argue with the Hall of Fame? If you look at the Hall of Fame, you can see that there's some very nice, everything up to 19, everything after 1949 is kind of chopped up, but up to 1949 it's pretty consistent. For those of you who like statistics, one of the ways to look at the proportions is to do the classic descriptive statistics. Mean and standard deviations give you a way of looking at it. For those of you who really speak statistics, this is actually mu and the thetas because we're dealing with population data. For those of you who don't speak statistics, a much simpler way to look at it is the mean is average, and standard deviations give us below average and above average and very much above average and very much below average. That lets us put together a very nice grid that we can look at the growth of the save to examine what's happening here. If we look at the Hall of Famers, we can see that by and large they have happened in the two most recent eras of Major League Baseball, and that the other eras have not. If you go a little bit farther and draw Hoyt Wilhelm into the picture, then you're covering the modern baseball era since around 1950. So if you want to be a relief pitcher in the Hall of Fame, it's good to have a career after 1950 because it disappears. below the it gets below average, below the 1950s. So the question we need to ask ourselves are, were there above average relief pitchers when relief pitching was below average? This is kind of like the Garson Keillor thing with the town in Minnesota, everybody is above average. If we look at it kind of closely, it's handy to divide the pre-1950s era into the dead ball and the live ball area. This is another one that's not totally controversial because the division is based on a massive rule change in the 1920s, so it's a handy place to start. In terms of research on relief pitching, most of the research falls in the live ball period. If you look at a chart of some of the major publications, and I realize that's kind of really hard to read here, if you look at that chart of major publications and put our Hall of Fame timeline on it, you can see that most of the research has been done since basically the 1920s, that gray areas on the right are just publication artifacts. That's when the publications were put out. The gray areas on the left are pretty much prior to the live ball. Relief pitching was ignored. If you look at the dead ball era, you can see why relief pitching was ignored. It's kind of like herding cats. There were teams with as few as six games in a season. 88 seems to be a nice large number until you get closer to the 1900s. So for those of you who do dead ball research, thank you so much. Herding cats is a very nice explanation of dealing with the data that comes out of this particular area. As a shameless plug to discuss this particular herding cats area, I have a poster out in the lobby where I will be after this presentation, both to answer questions about the poster and to answer any questions that we may not have time for during the presentation here. Once you get into the National Agreement of 1903, the number of games starts to stabilize. In fact, when you get into post-1904, we have kind of a long period where we have 16 teams and 154 games. The major leagues were very stable. The instability came in the 50s when you started getting teams moved basically to other television markets, and then, of course, the Giants and the Dodgers to the West Coast. More instability comes in 1961 when the American League expands, and then in 1962 when the National League expands. So for the purposes of relief pitching, it's kind of handy to discuss the Golden Age, which is the age of 154 games and eight teams in each respective league. So to kind of make it simple, just let's talk about it as the 20s through about the mid-50s. Just keep some ambiguous timelines so I don't have to say circa all the time. So what we're doing is we're looking at two different times. We're looking at the dead ball time prior to the National Agreement, and we're looking at this golden age of eight teams per league and 154 games. Jumping into this era, a key figure was Muggsy McGraw, not really known as a pitcher's manager, but Muggsy would actually have above average relief pitching in most of the years he managed the Giants. Whoops, got ahead of myself. Back here. There we go. Okay. Our good friends at Baseball Reference also give us the average number of saves per season, and McGraw was consistently above the average except for 2 years, 15 and 16, I'm having trouble seeing here, 14 and 15. That's when he lost Otis Doc Crandall to the Federal League. Federal League had more of an impact than has been given, has been credited to it. And I'm glad to see from the newsletters that there's some research going on there, because it was an important watershed in terms of many players' careers. If you look at the relief pitching from 1905 to 15, I can't see from here, is Doc Crandall saved a third of Muggsy's games, and his cohort, Hooks, Wiltsey, together they served half of them. Wiltsey was kind of at the end of his career when he hit, when the Federal League hit. After the Federal League, McGraw was above average, above the league average in saves every year except 1929. So he can be considered kind of a person who at least favors relief pitching. What he did is he left us the legacy of Doc Crandall. Doc Crandall was not a weakling. He won 100 games. He had an under 3.0 ERA, and he had double-digit saves in his career, which was quite an achievement in that particular era. If we take a closer look at him, one of the things we can do is take the number of games he pitched. He pitched over 300 games, minus his starts and saves, and that's going to give us his non-starts and non-saves. That's a multitude of sins statistic that covers holds, rainouts, extra innings, anything else that he showed up in a game for. So looking at Crandall specifically, you can see that he had 302 starts, 302 games, 134 starts, and 25 saves for 143 non-starts, non-saves, about 47% of his career. If you combine that with his saves, 55% of his career was coming out of the bullpen. This was very unusual for that time, particularly for a guy with that many starts. If you look at guys with 300 or more starts during the particular era, more or less, give or take a couple years on either side, Crandall was the only one who didn't start 60% or more of the games. But the little sidebar for me on that is, when I did this, I was absolutely astonished at how many times the starting pitchers relieved. Here in the modern era, very rarely does a starter relieve, but in this particular time frame, Crandall was literally the only significant guy coming out of the bullpen, so he's kind of our little prototype. If you look at him in terms of saves during that era, he kind of falls into the middle. He's not really a super winner, he's not really a super saver, but we can honor him as kind of our prototype for a relief pitcher coming out of up to, say, the rules making in 1920s. At that time, we start getting more into the individual save leaders. There are some interesting times where the league average is actually higher than the guy with the most saves on a given team. If you put down a nice scattergram of the number of saves, you can see that down in 1875, you could have an exceptional year with 9 saves. When you got into the 2000s, you had to get up into the 60s to have exceptional saves, or at least the high 50s. Because these are raw numbers, if you want to put them on the same scale as the chart we've discussed previously, you just create them as a proportion. You take the number of saves and divide them by the number of games the team played, and that's the same. That is the mathematical equivalent of the chart that was just presented, which is the team saves. But that lets you put them together on what statisticians call the common metric, which produces a nice little chart. And as you can see, our statistician friends would also say they're highly correlated. So that it makes common sense, but it's always nice when your metrics make common sense. So putting them both together, in the era of one save in 33 games, 9 saves was amazing. But when you get up to one save in every 4 games, 62 saves is a suitable amount of work. If you look specifically at the time frame that we're looking at, if you look in the 1920s, you can see that it's about 1 in 17 games, which works out to a team average of about 9 saves a season. By the time you get up into the 1960, you're talking about 1 in 7. I can't read that. Yeah, 1 in 7. And about 20 saves per team. So there's a constant linear growth here. since there are no Hall of Fame relievers in this era, to create a kind of benchmark for them, the four guys with the most saves during this period were all starters, who were Hall of Famers. Wade Hoyt and Lefty Grove saved about 50 games in their career. And again, in perspective, these are 20-year careers, so that's two or three saves a year. So it's not like they're coming out of the bullpen all the time. And then Carl Hubbell and Dizzy Dean come in the 30s, which it turns out is fairly typical for that era. If you look at some of the guys who pitched significantly in that era, oh, there we go, you can see that... Bob Schocke and Jeff Bagby and Garland Braxton all came in around 30 saves, and you start getting 40 saves in some of the other guys. But again, nobody's going over 50, and 50 is kind of a benchmark that you would expect out of a Hall of Fame starter anyway. You do find some interesting people who do get up around the 50 save area. My personal favorite is Jack Quinn, who was discussed yesterday at one of the presentations. Jack is kind of an interesting starting pitcher. He was a journeyman. There's no getting around it. The other one there was Willsey Moore. But Willsey Moore only pitched 6 years, and he was primarily a reliever, but he didn't really hang around long enough. Just as a quick sidebar, Jack Quinn is interested. I prepared this well before I knew there was going to be a Jack Quinn session. Jack Quinn actually had 10 more wins than Wade Hoyt. He also had a lower ERA, but he did have 36 more losses. So he might be an interesting look. There's not a whole lot of biography out of them about him, as you heard in the session yesterday. The guy who's of interest to us is Fred Ferpo Marbury. Marbury pitched from the mid-20s to the mid-30s, and he was the first guy to he nearly doubled 50 saves, so you're talking at a number that is at least palpable. If you put him in a chart of the people saves with various starting pitchers, one of the little things that jumps out is he was the first guy to get 20 saves in a season in 1922, which was kind of an amazing feat at that time. Remember, in 1920, a team would get 9 saves, so he kind of doubled the team. An easier way to look at him is if you put him in a timeline. Timeline's kind of an honored historical device, but it lets you look at his feats versus other people who pitched at the same time. Sometimes when you're looking at a table, it gets a little confusing, and you can see that there's just a tremendous gap between him and the next highest guy, which is Jack Quinn. So what we do is we honor him by saying he's kind of our first stepping stone towards modern relief pitching. With his 99 saves, he had almost 4 times as many saves as our prototype. Moving into the 30s and 40s, Wade Hoyt retired, but the other three continued on, so we're going to keep our standard of 50 saves for a starter and look at our second stepping stone, which is Johnny Murphy. Johnny Murphy is historically recognized as one of the first true career relief pitchers. He had 100 saves in the 30s and mid-40s, so he basically doubled career saves. So if you look at him compared to Lefty Grove and you look at him compared to Lefty Grove, you can see that he did double those saves. His next nearest contemporary was Al Benton. Al Benton had a kangaroo career. Benton had a kangaroo career, starting, relieving. And then I'm going to click through the comparisons that he has with other people so I can talk to you about. Well, so Johnny Murphy gets our second spot on here. Our third guy again comes up. 50 career saves didn't become feasible ever again. John Smoltz had 350 career seasons, but there was such an anomaly that, of course, it doesn't apply to the 20s and 50s. And so what we find out is that it was matched by a fledgling reliever named Hoyt Wilhelm. But Hoyt Wilhelm had two careers. He was a relief pitcher from 52 to 58. 59, he was a pure starter. He did not get one save. And then 60 on, he became a relief pitcher in the 60s. So though you look at his whole career, he kind of soars above everybody else, well deserving of being in the Hall of Fame. But when you read about him, you get two key themes. You get the knuckleball and old Sarge. About his pitching skill, very few say he was a good pitcher. They say he was the first over 200 saves. So we kind of can use him as a benchmark, divide him by his 1950s career and his 1960s career. Three quarters of his saves came in the 60s. The other a quarter came in the 50s. In the 50s, he was opposite a gentleman named Ellis Kinder. Ellis Kinder saved 102 games, not also second guy over, third guy over 20 games. And so a third guy over 20 games. And so he compared well to the 1950s Wilhelm, not to the whole career of Wilhelm. But in that time, in that frame, if you're living in that time frame, Kinder is going to have a better record than Hoyt Wilhelm. Just to give you an example of that, Marbury's 20 saves record stood for 2.5 decades before it got broken, and then once Kinder came along, it got broken pretty regularly, and we started getting 30 saves in the 70s. So Kinder, you can put him on the chart against with his whole 102 saves when he did match up with Wilhelm, or the seven seasons they overlap. He's still above Wilhelm in terms of his achievements. So skipping past the guys in his cohort, we kind of put Kinder up there as our third stepping stone towards the ultimate career of Hoyt Wilhelm. Even though he overlapped Wilhelm, he probably made him possible. Stop talking. Okay.
Keep talking, but Q&A.
Q&A. Okay, let's go to Q&A. Sure. Oops.
Is there, given that the scoring rules have changed significantly in terms of awarding victories between the dead ball era and the live ball era, how much of that did you factor in, given that, for example, a pitcher could start a game and pitch three innings and get credit for a win, and then someone like Doc Crandall could come in and pitch the last six innings and get credit for a save?
Right.
Did you look at any of that?
No. No, I did. I deferred to baseball research on that. Baseball research is constantly updating their statistics. In fact, when I first started this, and between now and then, they updated saves. And in this perspective, it's only looking at saves. I didn't look at wins, relief wins, because that's a factor of team quality. You're going to, in that era, if you have a good team, you're going to get more wins.
Also, to an extent, at least, prior to World War II, it's also a factor in being able to get saves.
Right. Well. Yeah. They didn't know they were getting saves.
Especially with McGraw, his teams would often get big leads early in games because they were good teams.
Right.
And McGraw would take out a starter and put someone like Crandall or Wilsey in, and they would get a save solely because that it wasn't really a conscious decision on McGraw's part to use someone like Crandall or Wilsey.
Right. In a sense, in a very strong sense, they were defensive substitutes. But when I use the term save, there's really two meanings to save. The one we think of as fans is, save the game, please. But if you're sitting down in the dugout, you're in the manager, you're, save my job, please. This is mostly guys who save their manager's jobs during this time frame. Question?
Yeah, but I think more interesting is the changes in the save rule. about prior to what? Boltzmann?
69.
69, okay, the official. But I think they gave saves for anybody who finished a game with the lead.
No.
No.
No?
No, you'd have to ask the Baseball Reference folks about that. Yes.
I was thinking of a distinction between quality saves and saves. You know, were you better in the
90s? 69 rule was applied. All retroactive computations.
All right.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, and...
Right, or you pitch in the eighth inning with a one-run lead and... a tying run at the plate, etc., as opposed to, I don't know, a three-run lead or...
Just over your answer, your question, in the 1970s, the 300 save relief pitchers pitched about 70% of their games an inning or less. In the 1980s, it was 80% of their games an inning or less. In the 1990s, it was one inning or less, 90% of the time. Joe Nathan almost did a perfect 100. He was up like in 98. So we have that information. It's possibly valuable to go back, but what I'm trying to do with this is to kind of get the sweep. We have, it's like, you know, right now there's a lot of discussion at these meetings about going back and figuring out RBIs, because the RBI wasn't official until the 1920s. And so they were getting RBIs and they didn't know they were getting RBIs. These guys were getting saves and didn't know they were getting saves. So one of the great things a history professor once told me is she told me that history is very messy. We can only organize our view of it. Actually, way back there. It's great to be agreed with. I've been married for 49 years. It's great to be agreed with. thank you so much for coming. Hey, come on down to my poster, and I'll be glad to talk to you as long as we can.